We've just finished a series of sermons called Living and Breathing the Gospel, which was a study through the book of Romans in the New Testament. And one of the things that Paul, the author of Romans, said many, many times is that what has unfolded in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus happened according to the scriptures. That is, that everything that's happened in and through Jesus is consistent with who God has always been and who he will always be. So this morning we're going to go back from Romans 900 years to the Old Testament and meet an unlikely hero who's going to meet the living God and discover what it means to be living and breathing the gospel every day and walking with the Lord who actually is there. Her story is in 1 Kings chapter 17, and I want to ask you to turn there in your Bibles now. If you need a Bible, you can borrow one from under the chairs in front of you. We'll be on page 299. While you're turning there, just a little background. It's 860 years before the birth of Christ, and under the leadership of their kings, Israel has turned away from God and is worshiping idols. If you've found chapter 17 yet, you just glance at the page to your left, you'll see in chapter 16 it says there that a man named Ahab has come to the throne of Israel, and he has forged an alliance with Israel's northern neighbor by taking Jezebel, the princess of the Sidonians, as his queen. If you look at chapter 16, just very quickly, verse 30, it says there that Ahab was worse than all the other kings that came before him. And with Jezebel at his side, they are positively wicked. Jezebel is a zealous evangelist for the gods of her people. And together, she and Ahab build a temple to the god Baal and erect an altar to Baal and his consort Asherah, right in the nation's capital. They bring in 400 prophets of Baal and 450 prophets of Asherah. They place them on the state's payroll, and Jezebel begins hunting down and eliminating everyone she can find that is faithful to the God of Israel, especially his prophets. So this is a uniquely evil time in the history of Israel. So far in the story, this kind of thing has never happened in Israel. Now, Baal, the god, has been around for a very long time. Baalism was practiced in the land of Canaan long before Israel came onto the scene, and he was worshipped as the god of the storm and the rain. He was worshipped as the god who gave life, life to the earth through rain, life to people through good harvests, and together he and Asherah gave life to families through the giving of children. Now, that may seem silly to us today, but just as it was then, so it is now. Ancient people and modern people actually are not that different. We want basically the same things. We want life and hope. We want security and joy and meaningful relationships. And if bowing down to Baal will give me those things, then so be it. Then that's what we'll do. If bowing down to my boss or my boyfriend or whatever will get me those things, then I'll do it. But everyone, ancient and modern, without exception, everyone is building their lives on something by faith. Israel had turned to Baal, the god of the rain and the storm, because Baal promised life and security, and so God gave them over to Baal. You may remember in our study of Romans, Romans chapter 1, that's what it says, that God gives us over to whatever it is we want to worship. If you look at chapter 17, verse 1, God's response is to send a prophet named Elijah, a man who trusts the voice of the Lord. And Elijah proceeds to launch a full frontal assault on Baal and his promises. He says to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." And so the contest is on. The God of the Bible versus Baal, the God of the storm and life. And these stories of Elijah that we're going to look at this week and next week offer a great opportunity to contrast the God of Scripture with all the other gods we may be tempted to build our lives on. And now we're going to meet a woman who will have to choose between what to believe and what to build their life on. Take a look this morning at verse 8. We're going to read verses 8 through 24 together. Here we go. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. As she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. And Elijah said to her, do not fear, but go and do as you have said. And first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. And his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, what have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son. And he said to her, give me your son. And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, O Lord, my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son? Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord, my God, let this child's life come into him again. And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. And the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son lives. And the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you're a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Elijah has announced that there will be no rain and not even a spot of dew in all the territory of Baal until he says so. And a famine follows, as you might expect. As the famine grows worse, Ahab and Jezebel seek Elijah to kill him. And so God hides Elijah near a little brook called Cherith. And of course, the brook dries up. So look at verse 8. God sends him south to Judah, to a nation that will be much more sympathetic to his plight, someplace where the powers that be will protect him, and he arranges for a wealthy landowner with oodles of money to take care of his every need. Is that what it says, class? Just want to make sure you're actually paying attention this morning and I don't pull one over on you. No, that is not what it says. The word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. I've commanded a widow to feed you. Now, class, for 1,000 points, who else in our story comes from Sidon? Jezebel. This is Jezebel's home turf. And Zarephath is the birthplace of Baalism. This is the heart of the region from which Baal comes from. This is a widow, who dwells in the very heart of Israel's enemy, the heart of darkness. Jezebel and Baal have invaded Israel with 850 prophets. And so God is going to return the favor and invade the very heart of Baal territory with one prophet and a woman who can barely provide, well, she can't provide for herself or her son. And we get a unique picture, a contrast between the God of Baal and Jezebel and Ahab and the God of Elijah and the widow. First, we're reminded again of what we mean when we say that the God of the Bible is a God of grace. Remember in Romans? Romans chapter 4, verse 6 says that salvation depends upon faith in order that it may rest on grace. When Elijah arrives at the gate of the city, he meets a woman on the very brink of starvation. She says she has nothing to give him. She's actually gathering a few sticks so she may bake her last handful of flour into bread, and then she and her son will die. Now, we've been reminded in the news in the last couple of weeks that even in the 21st century, women are the most exposed, most abused, most misused people in our society. But in this culture, where there are no safety nets, and women are treated as the property of their husbands and fathers, it is very hard to be a widow and alone. It's hard to be a single mom in any age. But to be a single mother with no one to care for you in this day and age is a very tenuous existence indeed. So her presence as the provider of the prophet of Israel is a surprise. But the biggest surprise actually isn't her gender or her economic status or her life situation. The biggest surprise in the story is that she is a Sidonian. She is not a Jew. Whatever you picture Elijah looking like in the story, she looks the opposite way. She is from the heart of Jezebel and Baal's territory, and these two people should be natural enemies. To give you an idea of how surprising she would be to the first recipients of this story, consider this. Almost 900 years later, in one of his very first sermons, Jesus is teaching in the synagogue of his hometown, and he's teaching from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. And he says to the people, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor." And everyone in the room is totally tracking with him. And, "Oh, this is great. Isn't Jesus wonderful?" And then just to drive home the implications of what he's really saying, he brings to mind this story. And he says, "In truth, I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut for 3.5 years and a great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the land of Sidon." You can read this in Luke chapter 4. The tenor of the room completely changes, and in a rage, they rush him and try to kill him. Why? What is so offensive about the story of the widow of Zarephath that the mere recollection of her memory would drive people to murder? Well, what God is saying to Elijah and to Israel, and what Jesus was saying to his people, and what we're saying this morning, is that salvation is not the privilege of a certain group of people or a certain class of people or a certain race of people or even religious people, but salvation is and must always be a work of grace alone by faith alone. And God is no respecter of persons in this regard. For people who take pride in the way they've lived their lives and conducted their business and raised their children and everything that they've done, that can be a very bitter pill to swallow. But that's how religion works, right? This is how religion works. If you do right, then God will bless you. If I give my tithe, if I pray, if I attend church, then God will bless me. If I do what's right, he protects me. If I do what's bad, he punishes me. But either way, I'm still the center of salvation. I'm the captain of my own destiny. That's how all religion works. God is teaching Elijah and Israel. Salvation is not a right you earn. It's not something you're born into. It is a gift that is given. And the widow of Zarephath is the epitome of this teaching. To all the world, this is a woman who looks like she's been cursed by God. You know, here she is in the heart of Baal's country, and she calls the God of Israel the living God. If you look at verse 12, that's how she refers to him. He is the God who lives. All of Israel is turning its back on the God who has shown them mercy again and again and again and again. And here's a widow with nothing who's able to recognize in what's happening around her the God of Israel must be the living God. Not only that, but she's been chosen to be the means by which God will actually save Elijah. It's very cool. Everything else that we may be tempted to put our hope in, all of our other gods, whether we're talking about your 401k or a special relationship or moral superiority or Baal himself, all other gods reward the competent and the beautiful and the strong and the pure, but the God of the Bible, the God of God, of the gospel and of grace, receives us by grace alone and no other way. Remember during Romans, during our series, we said, no one gets to experience the joy and freedom of the people of God except through the gate of I'm a wretch and Jesus has to save me. Now, some of you are here this morning and you are a mess. I'm sure you are. Some of you here this morning are a mess, and whatever that means for you, okay, you're feeling like you don't belong here. You're looking around and you're thinking, if these people knew what's really going on, they'd be embarrassed to be sitting with me. If they knew where I woke up this morning, they would run me out of this room. Some of you are looking around and you're thinking, if God really knew what I'm like, I wouldn't stand a chance. If you're feeling like you need to get your act together before God will listen to you and care for you, that is a lie. That is your pride talking to you. The one advantage that the widow does have over you and I, those of us who live here in the beautiful St. Croix Valley, the one advantage that she has is that she's no longer even to fake or pretend that she has it together. She doesn't even have the resources to lie about her situation. She's got nothing, and it's the only advantage that she has over us. I have a friend here at Faith Community Church who's experienced this very thing. Wham, 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 thing after thing after thing stripped away from her. Everything that made her valuable, everything that made her good, everything that made the world love her, just thing after thing stripped away, stripped away, stripped away. And now she's come to say, I am a wretch and Jesus has to save me. Some of us are a huge mess, but we have such nice cars and beautiful homes that nobody would know. Well, this is the goodness and the tenderness of God, that he loves and saves religious and irreligious people, but only by grace alone. But it's not the kind of grace that we would expect. Let's keep looking at our story. The first thing that Elijah does is he asks her for a drink of water. And as she turns to go and get it, he adds another request. He says to her, okay, so she turns to go get him water, and he asks her for something to eat, and she says, I have nothing baked. In fact, I only have a small handful of flour and a little oil in a jar, and I'm gathering these sticks so that I can make one last loaf, and my son and I will eat it and die. So here she is, just like I've described. She's doing exactly what I would tell you to do today. She's there in all of her vulnerability, all of her pain. Nothing is hidden. Nothing for her to take pride in. And Elijah's response is unsettling, because he goes on to ask her to give him the little that she has left and then to go take care of herself. I mean, does anybody else just kind of, oh, no. That's not right. The thing about Baal and all your other gods is that they will allow you the illusion of control, and God will not. So if I offer Baal thus and such, I'm blessed with rain and fruitful harvest. If it's a dry year, I offer more. But either way, I'm still in the driver's seat. I pray these prayers and I pay homage and my family is kept safe and so on. That's how religion works. And that's why religious people have a hard time with suffering, by the way. Because if you're suffering, well, you did something wrong. and you're being punished for it, you need to fix it. All of the other things that you're tempted to build your life on will do that to you. But grace does not. Tim Keller tells a story of counseling a person who's struggling to come to grips with this, and she says this really profound thing. She says, what really scares me is that if salvation is by grace alone, then there's nothing God can't ask from me. If salvation is something that I do, if it's something that can be earned, even just 1% of it, if I can contribute even just 1% to the work that God is doing in my life, then at least I'm a stakeholder and I should have some say. But if it's all grace from beginning to end, then there's nothing God can't ask from me. And I have no control at all. And that's a scary thing. And that's what's happening here. Elijah is asking her to give her very last 1% and let it go. Jesus says something similar 900 years later. He says, those who would try to save their lives will lose it. But those who will lose their lives for his sake and for the gospel will find it. Elijah is saying essentially the same thing, and I'm saying it this morning as well. If your life is a mess, don't hold anything back from God. Your life is a mess and you're hearing what's said and you hear that God is a God of grace, and so you want to come. You want to come and receive healing and forgiveness and all this other stuff. Well, just be aware that grace will ask you for every last bit of you, your priorities, your time, whatever is most precious to you, your last fistful of flour, whatever it is, he's going to ask for it, just so you know. Your sexuality, your body, your retirement, your just whatever. Okay, you pick it. Whatever your last fistful of flour is, he's going to want it. Verse 15 says, she went and she did as Elijah said. She and her household ate for many days, and the jar of flour was never spent. Neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord. If you're playing religion this morning, if you're building your life on what you can do or trying to justify yourself through this or that, it's going to end in famine. It is going to end in famine. Did you hear me? If you build your life on Baal or anything else, it's going to bleed you dry. It's going to ask you for very little up front, almost nothing. It's going to make all kinds of promises about how you stay in the driver's seat. It's going to ask for nothing up front, and over time it's going to bleed you, bleed you, bleed you, bleed you dry. The God of the Bible comes, and he asks for everything, and then he just gives, and he gives, and he gives, and he gives, and he gives. And it never runs out. What happens next is another surprise, not just for Elijah and the widow, but for us. It's a surprise because, again, it rubs against religious convention. Here's a woman who's doing everything right now. She's living by faith, and her story takes a drastic turn for the worse. Her son, her only son, all that she has in the world, becomes ill, and he dies. Her response is very telling. You look down at the text. She says to Elijah, "What have you against me? You've come to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." She blames herself. She blames Elijah. She never blames or questions God. She knows that she's a sinner. She knows she's not in control. Her son was going to die when Elijah showed up. She knows that she's not in control. But her question tells us that despite the... Just think about the situation. I mean, every morning she's getting up. And the jar was empty the night before, and now it's full again every single day. So in the midst of this miraculous daily provision, she is still thinking like a subject of Baal. Because when tragedy strikes, when her very worst fears come true, her immediate thought is, this is my fault. God is punishing me because of my sin. That's her question. Did my son die because of my sin? You remember again in Romans we said, when we suffer, the very first thing we question is the gospel. God has changed his mind about me. He's abandoned me, et cetera, et cetera. Elijah takes the child. He goes up to the second story. He cries out to God. He asks a different question. Based on what Elijah asks, I think it's fair to say he does not know what's going on. God is not whispering in Elijah's ear saying, "Oh, Elijah, watch what I'm about to do. This is going to really blow her mind." That is not happening. Elijah has no idea what's going on. God is not playing games here. And in his shock and grief, he cries out, "Lord, what are you doing?" And then it says, this is interesting, he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried out to the Lord, "Let this child's life come into him again." Now, as far as we can tell, there's a couple of things happening here. And if you've ever been grieved beyond the point of coping, you will probably relate to both of these. First of all, if you've ever seen a parent who's lost a young child suddenly, or you've seen a widow throw herself over the casket of her spouse, or just what Elijah is doing in some part is the natural response to unmanageable grief. It's to simply lay across the one you love and weep. Second, when it says that he stretched himself out, what it means is that he's lying face to face, eyes to eyes, mouth to mouth, hands to hands across the boy. He's stretched out in the prone position over the boy. There are a couple of ways that the body responds to grief. One is to curl up in a ball and grieve and grieve. The other is to lie stretched out. And what he's doing is he's praying with his body. It's a position of surrender. If you've ever been at the point of grief where you're like past the pain and you're just like, "Take me now," you know. You lie prone and you just say, "Enough. I surrender. I give up." And by lying on the boy, what he's doing, he's praying with his body and communicating his readiness to trade places. He's saying, "God, give my life to this boy. Let his death be mine. Let his life be mine. If you're punishing him for something, punish me. Hurt me. Take me." Have you ever been that grieved? "Hurt me. Take me. Kill me, and let my life be his." The woman's question in verse 18, "Did my son die for my sin?" The answer is no. God hears the voice of Elijah, and he raises the boy from the dead. The answer is no. God is saying no. Your son will not die for your sin, because someday my son will be stretched out for sin. My son will be stretched out for your sin. He will cover you. He will say, "Let my life be theirs. Let their death be mine. Take me. Punish me. I surrender. I give up. Take me, not them." I don't think Elijah knows what he's really doing, but he's acting out what God is going to do in just a few centuries. One day the Son of God becomes the ultimate outsider so that the widow from Zarephath would become a true insider. Now, is there anything else that you are worshiping today that will do that for you? Is there anything else that you're tempted to build your life on that will give itself for your sake that way? No. Last observation, then we'll be done. It isn't until she sees the resurrection of her son that the widow from Zarephath is finally able to believe fully in the God of Israel, to really put her whole hope in him. She says, last verse, now I know that you're a man of God and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth is truth. There's something about seeing her son raised from the dead that finally breaks her last barrier to faith. Death is so final. It is so final, it's so universal, and resurrection is so unexpected that any remaining doubt she had beforehand is finally gone. Now, this is interesting. Here's some trivia for you this morning. There are 6 resurrection stories in the Bible. I bet you didn't know that. 6 resurrection stories in the Bible, and all of them have women as the primary beneficiaries of the resurrection. So we have this widow receiving her son back, you know, for Lazarus. It was his two sisters. Jesus raised a little girl back from the dead. On the morning of Jesus' resurrection, it's a group of women who have the privilege of being the very first to see the empty tomb, to speak with the angels, of carrying the good news back to the others. And actually, it's a woman who has she's the very first one to speak to the resurrected Jesus. Why does that matter? Because women in Jesus' day, just like Elijah's day, weren't really worth anything. Their testimony was not valid in a courtroom. Their witness to whatever was not considered worth a hill of beans. They were basically and essentially property. So for the first generations of Christians, this little detail about the resurrection would have been very embarrassing. It was the fact that in all four Gospels, it's women who witnessed the resurrection first. They would have had to explain that. Now, we don't have to, okay? But they would have had to. It would have been an embarrassing detail, and yet it's there. In all four Gospels, they all say that. Why? Well, the most reasonable explanation is because it happened. The most reasonable explanation is that the detail's there because that is how it actually happened. There's no reason to make it up because it's not beneficial to make up. The most reasonable explanation is that there really was a resurrection, that Jesus is alive and at large, and that the hundreds and hundreds of people who saw him alive weren't hallucinating, but saw something real. There's only one reason to be a Christian, and that's because you believe it's true. If Jesus is not if he's not resurrected, then give yourself to something else, something that makes more fun, something where you don't have to come to a meeting every week, right? If Jesus is not raised from the dead, the Apostle Paul says, this is a sham, and you should flee. But if he is, if Jesus has been resurrected, if the God of the Bible actually has the power to give life, you would be crazy not to give every last 1% to him, not to pursue him with your whole heart, and not to trust him absolutely. For those of you who are still worshiping Baal or trusting in something else this morning, I invite you to repent. Repent and turn to the living God, the true and living God who gives life to the dead. Put all your hope, all your trust in him, and hold nothing back from him. Let him take over. For those of you this morning, like the widow, who at this moment are facing your worst fears, the diagnosis, the loss, that whatever. If the widow were here this morning to speak to you, she would tell you, hold on, hold on. You're in a room, by the way, full of people who have faced their worst fears. They can tell you that God is faithful. For all of us this morning who are trusting Christ alone, we have a meal that we're going to share together called communion. It's something that the Lord has asked us to do to remember him forever and ever and ever. It's interesting, isn't it, how often food is a part of the story of the Bible, is a part of our story today. God provided bread again and again and again, grace again and again and again. And this is just one way that we remember again. As we take the cup and we drink and we eat the bread, the cracker, we're reminded God continues every day to provide all that I need, grace upon grace upon grace. If you're a follower of Jesus this morning, we invite you to share in this meal with us. If you're not yet today, if today is the day you are turning to Jesus for the first time, come share with us. If you still have questions and you don't know, just let it go. Nobody's going to be watching you. It's fine. Just let it go. Make a decision today to find out. There are like 20 reasons to believe that the resurrection actually happened. I've only talked about one. Consider pursuing those questions.